That's good. And welcome everybody to the History on the Rocks podcast. It's your host, Cody, and joining me, the gold medalist.
Oh, God.
In podcasting co-hosts, my wife, Audrey.
Oh, well, thanks for that.
What, it's the Olympics.
I know. You've been watching a lot of them.
I just made that up on the top of my head, too.
Yeah, good for you.
Worked out pretty well. Oh, so this is our last Thursday of summer.
Oh, I'm so sad.
We go back to work on Monday. Kids come back to school on Wednesday.
Kennedy goes to daycare on Wednesday.
Kennedy starts daycare on Wednesday for the first time. Mom doesn't know how she feels about it. Dad's fine. I'm not worried about it.
I feel like that's a very typical thing. Dads are fine. Moms are worried.
No. I'm saying, you know, like with our specific child, she gets along with people very well, and she's not really afraid of people. So, like,
she hasn't gotten to that point yet to be afraid of people.
Well, and I think that's a good thing.
No, it is. It is
because, yeah. Like, I think once they start to see different people than mom and dad every day, like, I think it's better off. They'll get, or she'll get more used to.
Yeah, I mean, there's always there's so many more positives than there are negatives. It's just one. I don't get to spend every day with her anymore, and
Right. She's
going to somebody that is not family for the first time.
I mean, that is true, and but it's, you know, it's someone that I think we definitely trust.
Yeah,
because
for sure
she's a good fit.
Definitely, there. Yeah, I'm not concerned about that. It's just
Audrey.
I don't get to spend every day with her anymore.
I know.
Or every day, all day. I still get to see her every day.
I was going to say, if we don't see her pretty much every day, we're doing something wrong. Audrey's glass is not filled with red or white today. It's brown.
It is. Yes.
And there's ice in there.
I am drinking some whiskey.
Ooh.
I have some cab upstairs, but like, I'm not, it's not wine time. And I need to have something.
It's not wine time.
No, it's not.
I don't think it was beer time at 10:30 in the morning last week, but we did that. Or no, was
yeah,
that
but like I don't want a red at 10 in the morning either. Like I could do a beer, but
I could do a beer at 8 in the morning. It doesn't matter.
I kind of want that wine maybe like later. So
what is that?
This is Angel's Envy.
Oh yeah, that's right.
That Kendall got me for my birthday, which is like almost gone.
Yeah, like
you're
I said, my dad is a big fan of Angel's Envy. I am not.
I don't really know. Well, you said it's too sweet. I don't think it's that sweet.
And I don't think sweet's the right word. I think it's too, like, it's not, it doesn't taste whiskey enough for me. Like, I don't know. I can't really explain it because I'm not really a whiskey connoisseur. I just like to drink what I like. And I mean, sweet is the only way I can like put it. It does. I like a little bit of burn, and that doesn't have any burn.
Yeah, there is definitely a lack of burn, but I don't know.
Which
I
is
still
good
think
for
it's good.
Those of you out there who like to drink whiskey that doesn't have that. But
I mean, I'll drink a wide variety of whiskey, but I mean, it hasn't been my go-to lately, but. I like it, and it's good.
It's about to be whiskey season though, because it's fall. Fall starts the whiskey season for me. The cooler days, and then winter.
Ooh. Yeah, and that's probably
winter.
Well,
is
I don't know.
Just whiskey,
red
whiskey
wine,
heaven.
And winter.
Yeah, summer is like summer. I like beers.
Yeah, like if I want to
like
drink a
drinks.
Wine right now.
Yeah,
I want to drink like, a white. And
I'm
I don't
not
have
gonna
any.
Sit in 90 degree weather outside and drink, you know, whiskey on the rocks. I'd rather have like a mixed drink, like whiskey and lemonade. That's fine. Like Jack and lemonade or Jack and Sprite, something like that. But like, I don't want to drink like whiskey on the rocks when it's hot out.
Oh yeah, I can. Cause I don't want like, I don't like all the mixed drinks anymore. It's just,
that's too
sweet and sugary. And I get headaches a lot more easily than I used to. So I need to drink. Yeah. Like a beer. Straight up drink or wine.
Yeah.
The things that
change
after you have a kid
or have
too.
A baby. Yeah.
And still breastfeeding. So
that's true. That's true.
But anyway, what are we talking about today?
We are talking about, oh, by the way, I'm drinking Labatt Blue Light.
Oh, yeah, so, you're boring.
Yeah. Audrey doesn't like to ask me anymore what I'm drinking because it's usually like.
It's a beer.
I'm usually drinking Busch Light. I had one more Labatt's in the fridge that was left over from what we talked about last week. I was going to make a mixed drink, but at the same time, I was like, I got to go play hockey later, and I don't know if that's a right idea. we are going to talk about some Eastern Asian history today. We don't really talk about Asian history as much on the podcast, so that's why I kind of, when I looked up, this is going to be Historic Revolts and Rebellions Part 2, and I was looking up some topics, you know, some eras in history, and I was like, you know what, let's do some Asian history. So we are going to visit Japan and China today and talk about two of their biggest rebellions in that part of the world. So we're going to start with the Shimabara Rebellion of 1637 and to 1638. So a long time ago. It's the early 17th century in Japan, and there is a great upheaval and change occurring at this time, a lot of social and political change. The Tokugawa shogunate has just established itself as the ruling power and is bringing an era of relative peace and stability known as the Edo period. So a shogunate is like a party. Like a political party, almost.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this is an empire we're talking about, not a democracy or a republic. So a shogunate is actually this new political entity that's taking over Japan, and most people are on board with it. But not everyone is happy under this new regime. And in southwestern Japan, on the Shimabara Peninsula and the Amakusa Islands, tensions were shimmering.
Shimmering or simmering?
They were simmering. Because shimmering is to
glisten
or glow, right? No, they were simmering as in
boiling.
Boiling point. So that's what we're going to talk about today is these tensions on the Shimabara Peninsula and the Amakusa Islands. And basically why they were not happy about this regime taking over.
Okay. Interesting.
Now, yeah, it's... there's a lot of words I might mess up in here, so I apologize if we have any actual, like, Japanese or Asian listeners that know, like, the language and how to pronounce this stuff. Again, I am not trying to mock or make fun of anyone. I just really like the accent. Like people are like, oh, you're being racist. And I'm like, no, I just really like hearing people talk different languages.
Yeah, it is.
I think one of my favorite bits is Joe Coy's stand-up where he's talking about the difference between Vietnamese, Japanese, Koreans, and Chinese, like how they talk, and he does it perfectly.
He does.
And if you've ever seen his stand-up, Joe Coy's stand-up where he does that, like I literally would fall off the couch laughing and... Like, I'd have six-pack abs in the morning from laughing so hard at that stand-up routine. because, like, that's just how I am. Like, I'm not trying to be racist. It's just, you know, it's comedy. It's funny. And I just like to hear people, like, speak in their native tongue. And, like, it's just interesting how, like, differently people talk.
Oh, for sure.
In a, like even here. Like, we'll make fun of the Southerners. But, hi, y'all.
Oh, yeah.
You want a Coca-Cola? No, I want a Sprite. Yeah, Coca-Cola. They call everything Coke.
Or soda.
Yeah, soda. Like, we make fun of everyone, so...
Well, yeah, we also have East Coast.
Get over it.
East Coast family.
Get over it.
Talk funny.
That sounded a lot like the beginning. I think I might have done the same thing. Please don't listen to this and be like, oh, we don't like Audrey and Cody. They're racist. We're not being racist.
It's not meant to be racist.
It's not meant to be racist.
If you take it as racist, then that's your problem.
If you take it that way, that's your problem. We are seriously just digging into a different side of a culture that... is not talked about as much in our realm of the world. So here we go.
Okay.
The Shimabara Peninsula is located in Kyushu. It's known for its fertile land and strategic importance in the area of Japan because obviously being islands in Japan, They are close to the South China Sea, in which a lot of those powerhouse countries like China, Korea, you know, are very interested in the resources in that area. However, the region's inhabitants face severe hardships due to heavy taxation and oppressive policies imposed by the local daimyo, who is Matsukura Shigeharu. So the local daimyo is like a, for us, how we would understand it in our government, is like a governor.
Okay.
They're the governor of this region. So they, at this time, who we're talking about, Matsukura, is taxing these people heavily and putting oppressive policies on the people in this specific area. And to make matters worse, the area is actually a significant Christian population, which has a legacy of Jesuit missionaries who had been active in Japan since the mid-16th century. So, if you don't know anything about Japan...
Which I don't.
Okay. They are shocking. Not a Christian country. Okay. There's many religions in Japan today, but primarily... There is many different ancient religions that are prevalent to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And Christianity is not one of them. Christians in Japan at this time in the 1600s are a large minority.
Okay.
And like I was saying, it's because of Jesuit missionaries who had made their way over to Japan to spread Christianity, just like Columbus did when he conquered the Southern Americas, right, and Mexico and stuff. They came to spread Christianity as well. Okay. The same thing happens in Asia around this time, and that's why there's a Christian population here, but it's very minute. Okay. Now, Christianity took root in this region, just like what we were talking about, and many locals had been converting to it over the years. However, the Tokugawa shogunate viewed Christianity with suspicion and hostility, seeing it as a threat to their authority and social order. By the 1630s, the shogunate had begun a brutal crackdown on Christians, leading to widespread persecution. This is understandable because a government wants to be totally autonomous and in charge, right?
Yep.
The Christian religion, Jesus, is your...
Yes.
Ultimate ruler.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why I think that an empire like this, who these minority is what the word I was going to say minuscule, but the minority of Christians here, they don't want Jesus to be above their government. And that's how I think Christians, in this case, how we're talking about it, are viewing this religion of Christianity that has spread to them, and the conversion to it is that no one can rule me except for Christ. And so that is a threat, like we were talking about, to this authority of the shogunate and the social order that's supposed to be in Japan.
Yes. I think I get it.
Do you?
Yes.
You do. Do you? I do. Do you? Duty. So, against the backdrop of oppression and persecution, the people of Shimabara and Amakusa reached a breaking point with these very oppressive laws and rules against them. This rebellion began. See, now I'm making fun of the Southerners. I didn't even make fun of. I didn't even do a. What someone would call a racist Japanese impression. I made fun of the Southerners. The rebellion against... Okay. See, we just...
Anyway.
We just like to joke and have fun.
Yes, we do.
We love all of you. The rebellion began in December 1637 when a group of peasants, many of them Christians, rose up against the oppressive daimyo that we were talking about, like that governor, and the shogunate's harsh policies that we were also talking about, that were... primarily focused on Christians. There was a charismatic teenager named Amakusa Shiro who was seen by his followers as the messianic figure, so like the Messiah. So this Amakusa Shiro to Christians was kind of like Jesus' right-hand man, for lack of a better explanation. Does that make sense? So, like, yes. A messianic figure, like the Messiah, right? Your savior. That's what people are looking at this teenager as, because they're not afraid.
Is this teenager the one that they named the islands after in this area? Because it's the same name.
Yeah, it is the same name. The Amakusa Island. That's probably why they're called the Amakusa Islands, because that is their first name. Or the other thing could be, with Japanese names, Shiro is not the last name. Amakusa is the last name. The last name comes first, and the first name comes last.
Oh, yeah, we were talking about that with the Olympics.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So the first name is actually Shiro Amakusa. So, like, our surnames are different, right? Like, our last names, like, Amakusa, like, in Japan, I could see this being, like, they're from Amakuso, so they're Shiro Amakuso.
No.
Just, like, think of, like, German names, right? Werner von Lichtenstein. Werner from Lichtenstein. So, like, von Lichtenstein becomes the surname over time. But it really just
means they were from.
Like, they were Werner from Liechtenstein. You know what I mean? So that, I think, is might be what's happening here, is that Amakusa is the area that Shiro is from, and that becomes their surname because it's Shiro Amakusa. Shiro's from Amakusa.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Like, yes. I think that makes a lot of sense. And again, I'd have to look this up, but again, my best guess historically with how names go is, like, usually your last name is where you're from.
Huh.
But again, this Amakusa Shiro, we're just going to call him Shiro, not to mix up with the islands. We'll call him Shiro.
Sounds good.
Shiro is this messiah figure to his followers. Now, the rebels managed to capture Hara Castle, turning it into their stronghold to resist the shogunate. And for several months, they held off the shogunate's forces, who laid siege to the castle. But again, they were able to stop wave after wave from actually breaking down the castle and taking them prisoner. The shogunate determined to crush the rebellion, but they dispatched... Oh, I'm going to try that again. The shogunate determined to crush the rebellion, dispatched a large army supported by the Dutch, who provided artillery and naval support to them. Now, the siege of Hara Castle was brutal and devastating. The rebels, though initially successful in repelling attacks, were eventually overwhelmed by the superior numbers and firepower of the shogunate's forces, especially with the help of a large army like the Dutch. In April of 1638, the castle fell and the rebellion was brutally suppressed. An estimated 37,000 rebels and sympathizers, including women and children, were killed.
Wow, that's a lot.
37,000 people who rebelled against the shogunate were, like, that's almost a, what do you call it? Like, that's almost a genocide.
Yeah.
Like, if we're talking about persecuting a specific group of people, in this case Christians in this part of Japan, 37,000 people who are rebels and sympathizers, like, that's a genocide, killing that many people of the same, I guess that's not an ethnic background, but a religious background.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just food for thought.
Name wise, because I'm trying to look and see if you had gone into this. No. So, little information. His name, so he was AKA Amakusa Shiro, but his name is Masuda Shiro Tokisada. Then his Christian name was Geronimo, and later known as Francisco.
Wow.
So yes, it does seem like the location is Amakusa Shiro. Technically, like, second name.
That's a good find.
Yeah. Well,
that's a, no, no. That's a really good.
I'm gonna go with it is from Wikipedia, but
no, no, yeah, and that's fine. Wikipedia is Wikipedia is fine to use now because it has to be sourced information. It's not like how it was back when Wikipedia first started, where it could be garbage.
Yeah.
It has to be sourced, and it's reviewed now. So, say it again. What was his actual name?
Masuda Shiro Tokisada.
Okay, so that's his Japanese name.
Also known as Amakusa Shiro.
Okay, so he's got his Japanese name, then he's got his geographical name as Amakusa Shiro.
Yes.
And then you said he had his Christian name, which was Geronimo.
And then later known as Francisco.
And Francisco is a Christian name as well.
Yeah. So this says
which is like Francis.
Amakusa Francisco Shiro.
Gotcha. Well, that's really
born Masuda Shiro.
So that's really interesting because if you talk about Geronimo as in the Native American Geronimo,
mm-hmm.
He's also a kind of like this role. He's someone that all his followers look up to and that battled the United States Army for a long time and avoided capture for a very long time. So that's kind of interesting.
Yes.
If we're connecting historical figures who have rebelled against oppressors.
Yeah.
I don't know. Kind of cool.
Yeah. It's very interesting.
Great find, though.
Yeah.
Wikipedia or not. That's a lot of names for one person.
Yeah, definitely.
So the aftermath of the Shibamara rebellion has far-reaching consequences. It marks the end of the major Christian influence in Japan over two centuries, because 37,000 Christians were taken out, including women and children.
Yeah.
People were probably afraid to convert to Christianity anymore after this. The shogunate imposed even stricter isolationist policies, leading to the period known as Sakoku, or quote-unquote closed country, during which Japan limited foreign contact and trade. Christianity was driven underground, surviving only in secret communities known as Kakur Kirishitan, which is quote-unquote meaning hidden Christians. So that's actually really interesting because if we look at Japan today, they are a nation state, meaning that they have like 97% of their population are Japanese ethnicity.
Yeah, there's not like a lot of immigrants
going there
to live.
And this period known as Sakoku in the 1600s, early 1700s, meaning closed country, that's very interesting. Because obviously they were not allowing any foreigners in, because it says limited foreigner contact and trade. So I think they set their ethnic background and the future of their country in this rebellion in this period. And that, like, I teach this in AP Human Geography. A nation state is usually a nation that the same ethnicity, like Koreans, right?
Mm-hmm.
Korea is a nation state. Japan is a nation state. Like, your country has to be made up of, like, 90% of the ethnicity of that country. So Japanese is a nation state because they are 97% Japanese people that live in
there.
Japan,
mm-hmm.
right? So you can do that with any country, but, like the United States is not a nation state.
Absolutely not.
No.
None of us are from here.
none of us are originally from here except for the Native Americans. So we're a very diverse nation. So we would just be called a state or a country.
But we are.
Yeah. So I'm just the United States. I'm literally just thinking out loud. So this rebellion is, from what we were just talking about, it's really interesting because of how people will fight for the oppression of their beliefs, but the consequences afterwards, I think, are damning to where that diversity crumbled and the majority has been prominent for centuries now, even to this day, Japan being a nation state. So that's the Shibamara Rebellion.
So you didn't mention this, which, again, this is from Wikipedia, but did you read about what happened to him?
Oh, to him personally?
Amakusa Shiro, yeah.
No, go ahead.
Okay, so he was executed at the age of 17.
Solid.
and his head was displayed on a pike near Nagasaki as a warning to Christians. There's a movie about this, actually.
What's it called?
Well, it is a 1962 movie.
Oh, it's a long time ago.
Amakusa Shiro Tokisada, shown in English-speaking countries as The Christian Revolt or The Revolutionary.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Hmm. They put his head on a pike.
Yeah. For an extended period of time.
And then literally 300 years later, we dropped an atomic bomb on them in Nagasaki.
Yes.
Anyway, moving on from that.
Well, some more information for you on that topic.
That's great. Thanks for contributing.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah, that was a good find. You know, we try to keep these short so I don't go into too much detail, but
I think that was some pretty interesting detail.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. All right, our next story is the Taiping Rebellion, 1850 in 1864. So not to 1864. This happened twice. There were two Taiping Rebellions, once in 1850 and 14 years later in 1864. So this is probably one of the most important periods in Chinese history. Hmm. And it does say it took place in between 1850 and 1864. I just wrote it differently. My bad. Hmm. So this was a 14-year rebellion. This is one of the deadliest conflicts actually in human history.
Oh.
But outside of China, it's rarely talked about.
Hmm.
It's relatively unknown. And that's why we do this podcast, right?
The deadliest conflict in human history, but is relatively unknown.
Because China represses its history. Because they don't want people to know its negative points.
Okay.
So this is not highly talked about.
Hmm.
But this is the mid-19th century, and we're going to look at the causes, events, and aftermath of it. So to understand this rebellion, we need to start with the context of China in the mid-1800s. We have the Qing dynasty, who was ruling, but it was facing many challenges. There was corruption, economic instability, and natural disasters that led to plague the country with all these problems. And the population had grown significantly, leading to land shortages and increased poverty. Amid this time period, mm-hmm. and what's happening, there is a lot of suffering and discontent with the people of China, and a man named Hong Zhuquan emerged from the shadows. Mm-hmm. Now, he was a Hakka Chinese, which is an ethnicity of Chinese, and he had failed the Imperial Civil Service exams multiple times. After his third failure in 1837, Hong experienced a series of visions and dreams that he interpreted as divine revelation. He came to believe that he was the younger brother of Jesus Christ, sent to rid China of the demon, quote-unquote, king rulers, and establish a heavenly kingdom on earth. Now, by the 1840s, Hong had gathered a substantial following, particularly among the poor and disenfranchised. His teachings combined elements of Christianity with traditional Chinese beliefs, creating a unique and appealing ideology for many. So they had this new Christianity that's very popular at the time, mm-hmm. right in the 1800s, plus they got to hold on to their ethnic beliefs. So many people are going, oh, this is a very good combination.
Mm-hmm.
In 1851, Hong declared the establishment of the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom in the southern province of Guangxi, marking the beginning of the Taiping Rebellion. Only takes one person, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
One person, you gain those followers that believe in your cause, and this is very prevalent in history.
Mm-hmm.
The Taiping forces grew rapidly, attracting peasants, miners, and other marginalized groups. They were known for their strict discipline and revolutionary zealous. The movement promised social reforms, including the abolition of private property, land redistribution, gender equality, and the end of the opium trade, which we all know opium is a very addictive drug.
Mm, yes, it is.
Yeah, if you keep people on drugs, they stay impoverished and poor.
Mm, yeah.
But this is not a political podcast, and we will not talk about that. These radical ideas, coupled with Hong's charismatic leadership, fueled the rebellion's expansion. Now, by 1853, the Taiping army had captured Nanjing, which they renamed Tianjing, or, quote-unquote, the heavenly capital. This city became the heart of the Taiping regime. From Tianjing, the Taipings launched campaigns to spread their influence across China. At its height, the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom controlled significant portions of southern and central China, posing a serious threat to the Qing dynasty. So, the Taipings are now challenging the Qing dynasty on a very large scale because they are gaining momentum and gaining followers. And if you know anything about monarchies, right, and dynasties, this is a legitimate threat because dynasties run on blood. Mm-hmm. They are passed down through blood.
Yes.
Grandfathers to fathers to sons to sons to sons to sons. And when you have another group challenge you, this is almost like challenging your family's rule. Mm-hmm. It's not like a political party where you're, you know, trying to win a vote. This is a threat, a direct threat to the Qing dynasty and their bloodline,
yeah,
being monarchs. So the Taiping Rebellion was not without its challenges and internal strife. Leadership conflicts and corruption within Taiping ranks weakened their cause. Because obviously everyone wants a piece of this leadership pie and wants their own, you know, it creates these factions, mm-hmm, you know.
And I go, if they could do it, we could do it. We can overcome this.
Well, it's people with different ideas. So it's people with one big idea who have different ideas of how that should be accomplished.
Yes.
It's just like our Republican and Democratic parties, right? There are factions within both of those parties of how things should be accomplished. So it splinters them a little bit.
Yep, for sure.
And that's exactly what's happening here with the Taiping regime. Now, the Qing dynasty, with the support of Western powers like Britain and France, launched a series of military campaigns to crush the rebellion. Now, you bring in Britain and France at this time, those are the two most powerful militaries on the planet, mm-hmm, in the 1800s. One of the most crucial turning points came with the rise of the Qing general Zhang Gufan. Zhang's strategies and his well-trained Zhang army played a significant role in the eventual defeat of the Taiping forces. By 1864, after years of brutal warfare and staggering casualties, the Qing forces recaptured Taijing, marking the end of the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom. But there were 20 to 30 million deaths in the Taiping Rebellion.
Wow.
That's what makes it one of the deadliest conflicts in human history.
That is a lot of people.
Yes. Now, its impact on China is very profound, leading to significant changes in Chinese society and governance. And the rebellion exposed the weaknesses of the dynasty, the Qing dynasty, contributing to its eventual decline and the rise of modern China. So the Taiping Rebellion is a very important part of Chinese history, because if we look at modern China today, they're a communist nation. There's no denying that. And this is where they got rid of the monarchies. This is where they got rid of the bloodlines.
Mm-hmm.
And there were socialist and communist movements that spread throughout China and reestablished what their government was going to look like and basically turned China into the communist government it is today.
Hmm.
So the Taiping Rebellion was really the last attempt at a free China.
Interesting.
And it was successful in its aims because, mm-hmm, it eventually brings down the Qing dynasty. But when tough times come about, socialists, communists, Marxists take their chances to brainwash and to manipulate the masses,
mm-hmm,
to live under their rule. And if you look at Chinese history, and if you know anything about Chinese history as a listener to this podcast right now, that's exactly what happens over the next, you know, 140 years up until even today. So China has a very, very complicated government or governmental past and political past.
Mm-hmm.
And the Taiping Rebellion really snapped it off. Now, the Taiping Rebellion is a very overshadowed event by other historical events, because at this time, there's a lot going on. Right? You have England, you have France, you have the United States as a new nation mm-hmm. in the 1800s. That's building itself up. The United States is about to go into a civil war where millions of people are going to be killed. You know,
yeah.
Fathers fighting sons, sons fighting fathers, brothers fighting brothers, right? Like, that's what we know in our part of the world as a crucial event, that there's millions of deaths. But
yeah.
here we have 20 to 30 million deaths that are not being talked about in yeah. a very prevalent country's history.
So, like, what do you have any idea of, like, what the population at the time was? Because I know they have a very large population.
Well, China's population today is like 1.6 billion.
Yeah, and they have a lot.
I mean, it's
but like, it, what was it
back then? I'd have to look, but I bet you it's up in like the, I would say 600, 700 million people.
Yeah, yeah, still a lot, but.
Not as much as today, obviously, but yeah. still a large population for the 1800s.
And 20 to 30 million, regardless of the population, that's a lot of people.
I mean, look at the United States. Let's take the United States, for example, right? We have our states, okay? Mm-hmm. We have 13, 14 million people in the state of Illinois. It's hard enough for one governor to satisfy 14 million people. Now try ruling 700, 800 million people.
Yeah, you're never going to satisfy.
Let alone today, 1.6 billion.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
for sure.
That's ridiculous.
You're not going to make everybody happy.
Sometimes I have trouble with a classroom of 25 freaking teenagers.
Yeah.
You know?
For sure.
So this rebellion serves as a reminder of the power in ideological movements and the deep social and economic currents that can divide and drive people to revolt.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know how you were going to take these two stories because they're histories that you probably really don't know about.
No. I mean, I definitely have heard of the Qing Dynasty. Can I tell you anything about it?
Yeah.
The Qing
Dynasty.
I've heard that.
You learn about in world history. And also if you look at if you look at artifacts and stuff and things like in the news, the Qing Dynasty is usually the dynasty which a lot of China's artifacts and social reforms come from.
Yeah.
So you hear about the Qing Dynasty a lot. But I just thought bringing these, like a Japanese history and Chinese history into the podcast, these two were really important rebellions because it shows kind of the state of those countries today. Now, Japan is way better off. They're a capitalist society. They're a democracy now, and they don't have that empirical rule, and they thrive. Mm-hmm. You know, Japan thrives, let alone from their natural disasters that unfortunately happen over there, like the Fukushima incident and all that kind of stuff. That really has brought Japan's economy down, but they always find a way to bring it back up.
Yeah.
China, however, whole different story. that communist regime that still exists in China today is very oppressive to the Chinese people.
Mm-hmm.
But again, 1.6 billion, I think, is the population last time I looked. It might be a little less than that, but go ahead, look it up on your phone. But
let's Google it.
I'm pretty sure I'm in the right realm of it. It's like 1.6. It might be 1.3-ish. Might be about 300 million people off. But
2024, they probably won't be able to. As of August 7th, okay, that's today. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is the AI review on Google now.
Yeah.
1.4.
Well, okay, so 1.4. I was close.
Billion.
I was close. 1.4 billion. So that's taking mathematical. What AI is doing there is taking mathematical equations that we actually use in AP Human Geography to estimate the growth in population based off of many factors. So
it says it's a 0.03% decline from 2023.
Really?
And a 0.02 decline from 2022.
Oh no, China's on the
0% increase from 2021.
Okay, so they've become a little bit more stagnant, which is probably mm-hmm. good because I don't know how you feed that many people. And have that many, you know, those oppressive kind of laws that China does.
Well, don't they have like a limit on like children you can have? Isn't that something that exists there, so or is that something people say?
I teach it in AP Human Geography. We talk about antenatal policies and how there used to be. It doesn't exist anymore, but there used to be a policy in which you could only have one child.
Mm-hmm.
And
preferably a boy, and right?
Okay, I was just going to say, in many cases, if it was a girl, they would kill the female children until they got the boy.
Yeah.
And this is not so long ago this was happening.
So they don't do that anymore?
No, these policies are
so
not.
So like they can have multiple children.
Correct.
If they please.
Yes, their antinatal policies are no longer intact. But this kind of situation comes from, and any country can actually go to this. There's antinatalist policies and there's pronatalist policies. Antinatalists, they're usually trying to limit children, right? Mm-hmm. They're trying to limit population because they have too much and they don't have the resources to, you know,
provide for more people. Yeah. Bless you.
Thank you. Pronatalist policies, like Japan right now. I just read an article yesterday, actually, that was put out that Japan is really worried about their declining population. Mm-hmm. They have pronatalist policies in which they give tax benefits, tax cuts, to people to have children. Or they provide money to families to have multiple children so they can regrow their population.
Oh, so that'd be so nice.
It just, yeah. The United States is a stagnant. We talk about population pyramids in AP Human Geography, and these are actual graphs mm-hmm. that you can see by male and female.
Yeah.
And you can see how the population has, how their population is today, how it folds.
Yes, I remember looking at those because when you tried to take your AP test that
that's
one
right.
time.
That's right, yeah. But those show a lot of trends.
Yeah.
And that's why AI is allowed to, or is able to depict through, you know, just basic computer calculations, mm-hmm. either the rise or fall or stagnation of a population.
Yeah.
So it's actually really cool. I love teaching population pyramids because they're fun to look at. The kids like to have visuals.
Yeah.
And
for
it
sure.
tells us a lot of information about a country and which mm-hmm. way they're moving. And so like ours is kind of like a pillar. So like
yeah.
male and female on both sides is like straight down, and it's by age group. It's by age cohorts in 4 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So like they do cohort. There's a bar graph for ages 0 to 4, 5 to 10, 11 to 15. Right. And mm-hmm. those bars show the percentage of population. So ours is pretty even and it goes up and you can see life expectancy at the top. So when you get to the top, the graph starts to thin out. Right. Because obviously, unfortunately, people die.
Yep.
And in like African graphs, you'll see that they have a large child population and it looks like a natural pyramid, but it only goes to like age 60
because
their life expectancy is low. To where ours is like a pillar, right? It's even on both sides, which means it's stagnant, that the population is, it stays steady
mm-hmm.
and it goes up to about 78, 79 years old to where it starts to top off.
Okay.
So, like I said, you could take these population pyramids and you could tell a lot from them. You can tell that they have a large youth population.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell if they have a large working population between ages 15 and 64.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell what their life expectancy is based on these population pyramid graphs.
Yeah.
So, if anyone listening is actually interested in what I'm talking about right now, because I'm nerding the fuck out. Because I know I seriously love looking at these graphs and teaching my students about this. If you go to populationpyramid.net, you can look at every country in the world.
Mm.
And you can look at years and years back of population pyramids. Like you can look at today all the way back to, I don't even know, some countries go back to like the early 1900s. But you can see the trend over time as to how these countries have changed.
So do you know what country like has the highest life expectancy?
I believe it's Norway.
I was going to say it's got to be one of those.
I think it's either Norway or Switzerland. And the life expectancy, I think, of a female in Norway is like 86 years old.
Okay.
It's very high.
Average.
Yes.
Because like we have obviously people that live 86, but like that's
not
as many.
We also look at the human the Human Development Index, the HDI,
mm-hmm.
and if you look at there, it tells you each country's it ranks them from one to how. What did we say? How many countries are in the world? Like 200 and something.
Oh,
230
yeah,
or something.
Day.
We just looked up. It ranks them from one to 200 and whatever. and it tells you their average household income, their average education, and their average life expectancy. And those three figures create a percentage and then ranks those countries based on how well or not, or how not developed they are. What am I looking for here? I guess it is just how developed or how underdeveloped countries are. You can see it in a ranked order. Hmm. And it comes out, the HDI comes out every year.
Interesting.
And Norway, I still believe, is number one at the top.
Yep. I was thinking it was going to be that or Sweden or Finland.
They're all up there. Yeah. They're all up there. All the Nordic countries are up there. I think we're like 14th. The United States is 14th and falling.
I was going to say, 14, that's pretty good.
We used to be in the top 10 for development, and we've fallen. Yeah. We've fallen off a little bit, but a lot of European countries are in the top 10.
Yeah, because I feel like our life expectancy has significantly decreased, looking at our food and what stuff is put in our products that we consume, it's just so bad for us, and the European countries and just... not here. They don't put that stuff in their food.
Right. It's more natural, more organic.
Yeah. Which is causing, more illness and all that. Blah, blah, blah.
Well, this was a good discussion.
This was. I like that.
Yeah, I like this one. I like these two stories. I hope you all enjoyed a little bit different history here on History on the Rocks podcast. next week, I don't know what we're bringing yet.
That's fine. It's going to be a busy week.
Yeah, it's going to be a busy week. We're going to get something done, though.
Oh, yeah, that's fine.
We might do something a little bit more laid back, a little bit more fun. Maybe we'll find some common phrases and do some more common phrases.
That'd be a good one.
We haven't done that in a while. I'll go find some new ones, and we'll do another like list of 10 or whatever, because we love doing those. So.
If you need a new one, Emily Line has the book in her class or in her office.
Maybe I'll steal that from her on Monday, and I'll go through it. All right, everyone. Well, thanks again for joining us on the History on the Rocks podcast. Go enjoy your weekend. See some friends and family. Have some drinks. Relax.
Last weekend of summer.
Doo-doo-doo.
Coon Creek days.
Doo-doo-doo. Yep.
In Hampshire.
Yeah.
It'll be fun.
It'll be fun. All right, y'all. All right. We'll talk to you next week.
Cheers.
Cheers.